Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
In the legal world, there are principles of conflict of interest, and there's also a question of an appearance of impropriety. I would have wished the president had not gone down that road, because at the very minimum, there's an appearance that I would rather he not have opened the door to. I got to tell you, Donald Trump says things frequently that I wish he wouldn't say.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. Well, today we're doing something new and different, which is exciting. It's exciting. If you are listening to this, you probably have read who today's guest is. That's in the title of the show. And you're probably thinking, I really would like to listen to a little Ted Cruz on my commute. So you are in luck, because that is what we are delivering today. More seriously, this is the first of this fall's Live with Pod tour. We're doing four different dates. This is the first one where I do a live podcast, one-on-one conversation in front of an audience. The next one is coming up in October, and tickets to that are available but going very quickly. That's going to be in Los Angeles at the Ace Hotel, Monday, October 21st at 7:30. If you go to Ticketmaster.com, search Chris Hayes, you can find tickets to that. I'm going to be talking to the amazing Adam McKay, who is the genius behind everything from Anchorman to Vice to The Big Short, and an incredible sci-fi author, Omar El Akkad, who wrote an incredible book, American War, about a future civil war that happens under conditions of climate change. So that's the next one that's happening. It's going to be very different than this one, which you're about to listen to, which is a conversation with Ted Cruz. And I've seen people say to me, like, why did you do a conversation with Ted Cruz? And my feeling about it is, you know, he is he's an interesting guy. He is a United States senator. We don't really agree on anything. We have spoken to people across all different kinds of ideologies and political valences and backgrounds and forms of expertise. We've done freshman Democratic members of Congress. I don't think that With Pod is a podcast that I would turn into a weekly talk with a Republican senator. But I also thought, like, this will be interesting to try to see. Basically, I went into a thing like, here's a very, obviously a very smart guy who, to me, is a sort of fascinating figure in these times for this reason. What conservatism is in the era of Trump is incredibly up for grabs. There was a sense in which when Ted Cruz ran against Donald Trump in that primary, Ted Cruz's argument was, I'm the real conservative. And I thought, and many thought, that he'd sort of a better claim to it. He was much more a movement conservative. He had been, you know, a campus right winger, and then he clerked for a conservative judge and justice. He was a Federalist Society member. He had all the kind of bona fides, all of the check marks of, like, this is a conservative dude, a movement conservative dude. And then he lost to Donald Trump. And his argument about Donald Trump was, Donald Trump's not really conservative. And conservatives were like, oh, no, that's what we want. Like, build the wall. The guy that threatens violence at the rallies, who says, like, just knock the hell out of him if someone, you know, starts to protest. The guy who says we should ban 1 billion Muslims worldwide, who the judge who's judging me, who's an American, can't judge me because he's of Mexican descent. That guy, the guy who is the bigoted, offensive showman, con artist, that's what's conservative, and that's what we want, not you, Ted Cruz. And then so Ted Cruz has had to figure out, like, how is he a conservative in the era of Donald Trump? And so the conversation I wanted to have was, like, what exactly does conservatism look like in the era of Donald Trump, Ted Cruz? For instance, a big trade war that includes massively jacked up tariffs that are, according to one think tank, the largest tax increase in recent memory. And then to deal with the cost of that, $28 billion in direct welfare subsidies to farmers to take the sting out, all done through unilateral executive action and without the power of the purse and the Article I Congress weighing in. I guess that's conservatism in the era of Trump. Now, I think that the conversation, as you'll see, like, I had, like, varying degrees of success of sort of substantive engagement on this question. I think the foreign policy section is actually pretty interesting. We talk about some of the cleavages around isolationism, as he puts it, and interventionism, which are sort of, you know, caricatures, both of them. There are other sections where I'm less successful. And I think one thing that I would note here is that, like, there's a section in here on climate change that was kind of rough. And the reason it was kind of rough is that I did not expect Ted Cruz to go full climate denial. I expected him to do what most Republican politicians these days are doing, and saying, yes, look, the planet is clearly warming, carbon is playing a role in that, and then do a lot of sort of like three-card Monty with like China and India and jobs, and, well, we can't really do anything, we don't know how the models. But instead, he just like went like way super old school, the kind of thing you hear like 15 years ago about like the satellite data is incomplete, and actually there's more Arctic ice now, and like there's just like a bunch of stuff being thrown around, all of which is not really worth kind of like debating, like the sort of scientific consensus on the just basic facts of the fact that the world is warming is so robust, and the product of literally, and I say this without exaggeration, trillions of points of data. Anyway, you'll hear that section. But I guess what I would just say about that section is, like, he does not think the world is warming is basically the takeaway there, which to me is another interesting moment to think about what conservatism is. But it's also interesting to hear him disavow the Iraq war, which he says he didn't support. It's interesting to hear him talk about Trump's diplomacy. And at the very end, we get to talk about the Ukraine scandal and what that means. And he does concede some things about how bad it all looks. On the Ukraine scandal, when we talk about the Ukraine scandal, we both use the word transcript as a shorthand for what is the call notes. It's not an actual word-for-word transcript. It is unclear whether a word-for-word transcript actually exists, although it's suggested that one does exist. Dianne Feinstein has actually asked for it to be released, but just don't tear your hair out while we use the word transcript. Okay, I hear you. It's not the actual transcript. So it is, I think, both an interesting conversation on its own, and also, I think, an interesting artifact in thinking about where the conservative movement, where conservatism and the Republican Party is precisely at this extremely fraught and perilous moment.
So I was thinking about how we were going to have this conversation, and I thought I would start in a place where I think we agree. And that's about...
Okay, my job here is done.
So, I think there's a belief among a lot of liberals that the public protestations of people in the Republican Party about Donald Trump are essentially duplicitous and two-faced, right? That Lindsey Graham or yourself are saying one thing in public and then saying another thing in private. And you see folks like Justin Amash says this is true. And I am of the belief that that's not true. I'm of the belief that I take Lindsey Graham at his word, I take you at your word, and other conservatives, that conservative Republicans think Donald Trump is a great conservative president. They like and admire Donald Trump. They think what he does is good, that he is a great leader, and that they would be happy with Americans determining how they felt about conservatism, the Republican Party, by determining how they feel about Donald Trump. Do you agree?
I actually think it's more complicated than that. What I hear from Texans frequently is that they like the policy that's being enacted. They like the substantive policy victories. The country's doing well. The economy is booming. Incomes are rising. That they like. I hear from Texans all the time, you know, I wish someone would take away his Twitter.
Right.
You know, my sentiment, as you know, Donald Trump was not my first choice for president. But he won. And when he won, I had a job to do, which was represent 28 million Texans and work with him. And I think on the substance, we've accomplished an enormous amount.
I mean, this is the way primaries work, right? I mean,
sure,
Barack Obama ran against Hillary Clinton largely on her foreign policy judgment.
Yeah.
And then she was Secretary of State. So, but I am interested in, like, in conservatism, because I think that, like, the argument you made against Donald Trump, to me, wasn't just a tactical argument. Yeah. It was actually a persuasive one. The argument was, he's not a conservative. I am. I have the better claim to the term. Were you wrong? Have you come to realize that he is a conservative?
3 years ago, there was good reason to doubt, to say, I don't know what Donald Trump will do as president, because his record on a lot of issues had been in more than one place. I expressed those doubts vigorously. I will say the performance, the actual substantive performance we've seen, has been more conservative, has produced better results than I think almost anyone had a right to expect. Now, I think there are a couple of things driving that. One, I and other conservatives work with him very closely. I mean, I view a big part of my job as trying to encourage him to move in a positive direction and discourage him from moving in a negative direction. And on a lot of issues, not everything, but on a lot of issues, he's been listening to me, he's been listening to other conservatives. I think that's a good thing. I think it is also the case, I have said more than once, this might surprise you, thank God for Nancy Pelosi and thank God for Chuck Schumer. And let me tell you why. Look, Trump, at a fundamental level, is not complicated to figure out. He likes people who praise him, and he hates people who criticize him.
President Zelensky had that figured out, too. I mean, he did.
If Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi had come in and said, Mr. President, let's work with you. By the way, I'm pretty sure Trump had been a donor to both of them in the past. This was not a crazy concept that they might work together. I actually shudder to think what would have happened to the country.
So you don't think he fundamentally does have an ideological bearing?
Oh, look, I think he makes decisions. I think he has backbone. I think he has boldness. So I'll point to, for example, two foreign policy decisions that I think were critically important. Number one, moving our embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. I think that was a hugely important decision. It was also a decision presidents, both Republicans and Democrats, had promised to do that.
That is true.
And both Republicans and Democrats had broken that promise.
To back to your point, Chuck Schumer did applaud that decision.
Yes, but he also didn't attend the opening. I was there in Jerusalem for the opening, and no Democrats attended the opening, which is a separate issue. I mean, look, when it comes to Israel, I'm very worried about the sentiments that are rising in the Democratic Party. But let me for a moment focus on this different aspect, as you were asking about Trump's decision-making. On moving the embassy, both the State Department and Defense Department argued vigorously against moving the embassy. A number of folks, including me, weighed in with the president vigorously on the other side, and he had the backbone to move it. I think that was an incredibly important decision, and I don't think it was coincidental that the very same week we opened the embassy is also the week that he pulled out of the Iran-Obama nuclear deal, which I think is the most important national security decision of the last 3 years.
So I think you and I disagree strongly on the merits of that deal. So just to table that for a second, but to talk about this dispositional inclination of his, which I think there is a kernel of it that I think people, particularly on the left, admire or want to see in their own leader, which is the establishment, whatever it is, and whichever part of the party, will always come in and tell you, here's why you can't do X. I know that you told all these people that you were going to cancel student debt, but now you're the president and you can't do this thing. And I think there was a similar argument made to him about moving the embassy. And he said, screw it, I'm doing it. But there is a flip side to that too, because there's also times where people in the establishment, people in the civil service, and the people who are the experts say, you shouldn't do this. And it's kind of important to listen to them.
I think it's important to know how to get things done. And understanding Washington, understanding the swamp helps to get things done. But I do think dispositionally, you know, Ronald Reagan famously said, paint in bold colors and not pale pastels. I think elections are about choices. I understand why Democrats are drawn to candidates who have a bold vision. Yeah. Now, it so happens that I think the vision they're advancing doesn't work, that it's bad policy ideas. But I think a president having strength and boldness is a really good characteristic. I also think the fact that because the far left has such animosity for Trump, Schumer and Pelosi started the administration just savaging him.
Yeah.
And I think it resulted in a much more conservative set of policies being implemented.
I think as a description of the president's behavior, I think that's probably likely true. I think in some ways, I would say it was more than the far left in terms of the people that didn't like. I mean,
sure.
There's a lot of like people consider themselves moderates who are in the Dallas and Houston suburbs, for instance, who are pretty worked up about him. But on foreign policy, let's start there and sort of, I want to pivot away from the president and talk about conservatism and debates within conservatism.
Sure.
So there's one place there's a really interesting debate in conservatism is about the neocons, as the sort of folks like Rand Paul kind of derisively call them.
Right.
And folks who are extremely wary about additional foreign military intervention by the United States. Where do you come down on that debate right now? And to me, it looks like the tide is shifting away from the Boltons and towards the Rand Pauls in the Republican base. Would you think that's accurate?
So this is an issue I've talked about a lot and thought about a lot. And the short of it is, I think both of those polls are wrong. So traditionally, Republican foreign policy has been divided on a spectrum with, on one side, interventionists and, you know, people like John McCain or a Lindsey Graham or maybe a Marco Rubio or Tom Cotton falling into that camp.
Yep.
And then on the other side, what has been characterized as isolationist, people like Rand Paul most notably typify that.
But going all the way back to Robert Taft, I mean, this is a very long tradition.
Sure. I've always described my view as a third point on the triangle. And I consider myself a non-interventionist hawk. Now, what does that mean? That confounds the sort of easy stereotype. So let me explain that with some detail so that it has more clarity. I think the central touchstone for all U.S. foreign policy and for any military action should be defending the vital national security interests of the United States. I think we should be laser focused on that. So let's put that in application so it's not abstract. When it came to military action against Syria that President Obama proposed, I opposed that.
Yep.
The reason I opposed it, and I initially kept an open mind. I said, let me hear the commander-in-chief explain why this defends our national security, it keeps Americans safe. I listened to the arguments and they couldn't present any clear objective that was making us safer. I opposed that. I likewise think it was a mistake when the Obama administration led a coalition of countries toppling Gaddafi in Libya. When we did that, Gaddafi was a bad guy, but into that void stepped radical Islamic warlords who made it a much worse place. I think the Iraq war was a mistake for the same reason. As bad as Saddam Hussein was.
Did you come out against the Iraq war at the time?
You know, I didn't. I wasn't engaged in foreign policy fights on the time. I was engaged on domestic policy.
I was 25 and in the streets. I mean, you were a grown-up citizen.
Yeah, you're a pundit. I was a lawyer.
Right.
So I was not, we were doing...
Well, I wasn't, I was just a freelancer. But I guess my point is that it's easier to say now that Iraq was a mistake...
Yeah, but let's be clear.
...than it was at the time.
I've said Iraq was a mistake for a long time. In the 2016 presidential elections, I said Iraq was a mistake over and over and over again. I believe if we look at what happened, as horrific as Saddam Hussein was, and I'm not naive to think he was a nice guy, he was a terrible guy, but toppling Saddam opened the door to ISIS. My point is, on all of those... The policy positions I hold are in agreement with Rand and some of the isolationists. However, Iran I look at fundamentally differently. And the reason is the Ayatollah Khamenei is a theocratic zealot who pledges death to America. And in long and short, I believe him. I think that is a real religiously driven fervor that is profoundly dangerous. It's why I've opposed the Iran deal so vociferously. I think we should do whatever is necessary to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
Including military action.
If needed, if necessary. And
look, you would be, so bombing them.
If we got military intelligence, if we got credible intelligence that they were at all close to getting nuclear weapons and military force was the only way to stop it, absolutely yes. But look, I have no interest in invading Iran and trying to turn them into Switzerland. I would be perfectly happy leveling their facilities.
Well, okay, but let's play it out. I mean, it doesn't stop with a bomb. So you say, I don't want to invade them and turn them into Switzerland, but if we have to intervene militarily...
Actually, have you looked at like how Israel defends itself? It often does stop with a bomb. When you build a facility, Israel bombs the hell out of it and leaves. Like
that has happened a few times, yes.
And part of my view... When I say,
but you cannot, the enemy gets a vote. You don't get to control the reaction of your intervention.
So, but here's a point where actually I think the assumptions are counter to what a lot of folks, particularly in the media world, understand. Reagan referred to it as peace through strength. Mm-hmm. I think the dovishness of the left invites conflict. I think it increases the chance of military conflict. And Reagan... It's worth remembering, in 8 years, the biggest country Reagan ever invaded was Grenada. So he rebuilt our military, he took on the Soviet Union, he won the Cold War, but he was very reluctant, as am I, to send our sons and daughters in harm's way, and there's only one reason to do that, and that is to protect the lives of Americans and our allies.
But he also, and we'll move on from this, but he also did a 180 on a nuclear deal. I mean, he came in viewing Russia as essentially an implacable foe that can only be browbeat. And I know what you're going to say, well, peace through strength, and he got them to the bargaining table. But he also changed his mind. I mean, what happens with START and what happens with the bilateral deals that he strikes ultimately with Gorbachev and that are signed in Reykjavik is that he comes in with one position and comes out being essentially a nuclear arms deal maker.
Undoubtedly, and it's one of the great legacies, but
yes, I would agree with that as a liberal.
But peace comes through strength. So if you look at the Carter administration, when we dealt with the Soviets, we dealt from a position of weakness. Reagan, number one, revived the American economy, cut taxes, he repealed job-killing regulations, the economy soared. That economic strength, and I know we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, which I'm happy to do, that economic strength in turn helped fund rebuilding the military. But then he also took on making the clear ideological case. So when Reagan said the Soviet Union is an evil empire, the intelligentsia was horrified that this ignorant cowboy would say such a thing. When he said Marxism-Leninism will end up on the ash heap of history, again, D.C. was horrified. In my office, if you come to my office in D.C., there's a gigantic painting of Reagan standing in front of the Brandenburg Gate saying what I think are the most important words any leader said in modern times, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. That clear leadership from strength is what helped.
But wait a second.
Yeah.
That's the exact opposite of what is happening with North Korea right now. Right now, the president, let me just
say, I
have
real concerns about our policy in North Korea. So
I mean, what's happening is in some ways it's every bit the opposite. The president isn't just saying, I want to do a deal with them, which, again, I would favor. He's actually saying, he's a great leader. I literally love him. He writes me these beautiful notes, and I think he is a great leader for his country. It is a gulag state that every part of the American spectrum of political ideology agrees is one of the most ghastly mad scientist experiments in human subjugation that exist on the globe.
So, Chris, after this, I'm going to do my very best to write you a beautiful letter. So I hope it has sticking power. Look, I believe the most powerful tool in politics and in diplomacy is the bully pulpit of the presidency. I wish this president used it differently. When it comes to North Korea, although I will say this, look, I think there has been strength in dealing with North Korea compared to where the Obama administration was. And I will say, if you go back to the North Korea deal that Bill Clinton led.
Mm-hmm.
The North Korea deal at the time was we had sanctions in place against North Korea. Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father, was the dictator. And we negotiated a deal, the United States led. We lifted the sanctions. We let billions of dollars flow in exchange for a promise not to build nuclear weapons.
Also monitoring.
Well, okay, also
we
monitoring.
We had cameras in the factories, and we had an inspection regime.
Agreed. And it was an absolute failure. Kim Jong-il took the billions, built nuclear weapons, built ICBMs, has targeted the United States.
Bush pulled it out of the deal in the first 6 months.
It was an absolute failure. It didn't work.
The deal never happened.
Of course the deal, what happened was...
Bush pulled
was,
out of the deal. What happened
was the sanctions were relaxed and the money flowed in.
Okay.
When you give someone billions of dollars, look, there's a reason.
Wait a second.
There's a reason nobody goes and studies at the Neville Chamberlain School of Foreign Policy.
Right, but I totally agree with
that. Giving billions of dollars to dictators and tyrants is a profoundly foolish move.
I think there's moments where it might not be foolish, but putting that aside.
Which dictators and tyrants should we fund their aggression?
I think everything is a cost-benefit analysis of the possibility of military engagement, the cost of military engagement, and the possibility of peace. And I think that often the bias of Washington, D.C., and I think actually you would agree with this, the bias of Washington, D.C. is to undercount the cost of war. We have spent, by some estimates, and it's hard because it's a dynamic situation, there's both the Treasury and there's other related cascading costs of war, $6 trillion on permanent war since 2001. $6 trillion. There are proposals coming from Democratic candidates where people say, well, that's crazy. That's going to cost $1 trillion. We spent $6 trillion. We're spending money right now in Afghanistan in the longest war in the history of this republic. So my baseline assumption about foreign policy is, and I think in some ways you agree with this, right, that the bias of Washington is action, the bias of Washington is intervention, and the bias of Washington is to discount the cost of military engagement.
I agree, but I'll tell you part of the reason. So if you look at the interventionists, which have been the dominant stream of foreign policy in Republican thought for some time now, they have a view that we can go and vindicate democracy and cause these gardens of Eden to spring up where dictatorships had reigned. I think that's hopelessly naive. Now, I believe there's a powerful role for America to speak out for freedom, to encourage democracy, to use the bully pulpit.
Completely agree.
You know, Reagan in front of the Brandenburg Gate.
Right now, China's got a million people in concentration camps in Western China.
Absolutely. And you know what's interesting about when Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall? Three times the State Department crossed that out of the speech. Three times Reagan wrote it back with his own hand. And the State Department argued, Mr. President, you can't say this. It's unrealistic. It's too belligerent. And most importantly, it will never work. It will never happen. Reagan wrote it back and he said, this is the whole point of the speech. Here's the powerful thing. Within 3 years of that speech, that wall was torn to the ground. And it wasn't torn to the ground by American tanks. We didn't bomb it with American missiles. It was American strength and clarity and sunshine and light. But
that is, again, that is the opposite of what is happening now. The president goes around talking about how much he likes every dictator.
I have said more than once, I wish the rhetoric from the president were different. That being said, I think compared to the Obama administration, we are much stronger dealing with our enemies than we should be. Our language isn't, but our substantive actions are.
So
I would like our language to match our actions. That would make me happier.
All right. So let's table that for a second because I think fundamentally I disagree, but I feel like I have a good sense of where you're coming from.
And let me make a very just quick point on this also. Whether North Korea or China or Venezuela.
Or the Saudis.
One of the things that I think is important doing. So I'm happy to get to the Saudis. I think the Saudis is a more complicated question. I think there is an important value in highlighting dissidents and shining a light on people being persecuted. So whether you talk about the Uyghurs in concentration camps, whether you talk about Tibetans being slaughtered, I mean, I repeatedly try to shine a light by name on dissidents being persecuted because there's a power to that. And I think we ought to be doing more of that. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm prepared to send in the Marines.
Right, yes.
Unless it is necessary to keeping Americans safe. I think that's the justification for military force.
I think that division of labor there is one that I broadly agree with, that it's really important for both civil society and for leaders to speak out and apply pressure on things like the concentration camps of the Uyghurs. But it is very dangerous to think of military intervention as being the solution to that. I think that's generally a correct framework. If we can, I want to talk about some domestic policy issues.
Sure. Okay, so it's me again. Hi, I'm in the recording studio. You hear my voice is different than in that auditorium. Well, we're going to hear that discussion about domestic policies, which of course includes climate policy and impeachment. I think you can guess there are some disagreements between the two of us, and we'll hear that right after this break.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
I thought it was really interesting. So there's a climate strike happening and a lot of Fox folks, you know, ridiculing Greta Thunberg and the climate strikers. And Dan Crenshaw, who, of course, Texas congressman, sort of freshman star and very much an avowed conservative. It was very interesting. He tweeted something basically saying, look, again, these people are wrong. Their ideas are woolly-headed socialism, blah, blah, blah. But we do need to reduce carbon emissions, which I thought, huh. So I just want to start with the basics. Like, do you accept that human activity is putting carbon in the atmosphere, the carbon is warming the earth, and we need to reduce carbon emissions?
All right, so you had three statements there. Statement number one is unequivocally correct. Statement number two or three, the data are mixed.
And they're not mixed.
And let me start with just
they just aren't mixed. You guys, seriously. So,
see, this is what's known as sort of intelligent scientific discussion.
Yeah.
But actually, look, that screaming says something. I am the son of two scientists. My parents are mathematicians and computer programmers. I believe in science. I believe in data. I believe in following science and data. I think what is dangerous about the climate movement is it has become an emotional primal scream rather than being driven by science and data. I'm perfectly happy, and I think we should have conversation about data. And let me say more about that.
Let me ask you there. How much time have you spent with climate scientists?
I've chaired multiple hearings, hearing testimony from multiple climate scientists across the spectrum. I've heard people who are both...
There's just not a spectrum, though. There's a spectrum. Here, let me say this.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what, Chris. Let me encourage you to watch. So I chaired a hearing in the Commerce Committee. I used to chair the Science and Space Subcommittee. I chaired a hearing on the data behind global warming. We had a number of witnesses. I encourage you to read their testimony. These are respected professors at academics, and they had a range of views. I can tell you the climate alarmists, if you go back to the 60s. In the 60s, there were a series of predictions. The world is ending in 10 years. In the 70s, the world is ending in 10 years. In the 80s, the world is ending in 10 years. In the 90s, the world is ending in 10 years. Their predictions keep being proven wrong and dramatically wrong, not even a little bit
wrong. But first of all, let's go back to those three points of contention. We're putting carbon in the atmosphere. Agreed.
Undoubtedly. That's a statement of fact.
Carbon warms the atmosphere is a statement of fact.
Well, that they're actually mixed data. So if you look at the data, so let's actually talk about what the data is. Don't roll your eyes and say, oh, goodness, don't have disputes.
No, because the disputes are not on the physical impact of carbon on the atmosphere.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, so let's actually talk about, there are two principal sources of data on temperatures. They're number one, the ground level buoys that are measuring temperatures. They're number two, the satellites that are measuring temperatures in the satellite. The satellite data for 18 years have shown zero statistically significant warming. And here's the problem.
You think the Earth is not warming right now.
So did you notice a few years ago...
Wait, do you think the Earth is not warming right now?
In the last 2 years, what happened to the Earth's temperatures?
We have had 9 of the 10 hottest years on record in
the last
10 years.
The last 2 years, the Earth's average temperatures, according to NASA, dropped 0.5 degrees in the last 2 years. I mean, those are facts.
Okay.
Now, there's a...
That's not...
All right, you can speak and then I'll speak. We don't need to...
No, I just... My question is, I'm just asking for the general trend here. So, I mean, I think we've come to the answer. You do not think the Earth is warming.
I think we should follow the data. And so here's the testimony the Senate heard. In terms of the climate, so the computer models for climate show that the Earth should be warming dramatically. You remember the hockey stick, that it should be going up really fast? The satellite data that have thermometers that are actually measuring the temperature don't show that. There's a term for that. It's called the pause. And the reason it's called the pause is because the satellite data don't match the computer projections. And did you notice a few years ago the terminology changed? Actually, people don't say global warming anymore.
Wait a second.
They say climate change. And that was driven because the data didn't match the projection.
So just to be clear, I just want to be clear on your stance. You think the data does not show the Earth is warming and that we're not warming right now.
I think the data are mixed. I think there have been years and periods where there's been warming. There are years and periods where there have been cooling, and the data are mixed. I'll give you another example.
Wait, so you don't agree with Dan Crenshaw here?
Let me finish this sentence. Al Gore, in 2008, said within 5 years there will be no ice on the North Pole. Now, the interesting thing is you can go and test that prediction. That was 2013, and it is totally laughably entirely false.
There have been wrong predictions, but there have also been a million right predictions. I mean, you have seen what's happening in Glacier National Park. You have seen what's happened across the Corn Belt.
So let me ask you a question. Polar ice caps today, is there more polar ice or less polar ice than there was 10 years ago?
There's about the same.
Actually, slightly more. And actually, the phenomenon we're seeing is on the Arctic, it's decreasing some. On the Antarctic, it's increasing some.
But the sum total of this, and it's sort of a strange dance we're doing, because again, I'm not a U.S. senator, you are. I'm just asking, is the Earth warming? And what you're giving me back is an argument that it's not. And then you're saying, well, I believe in the data. But what you say is, you are saying that the data shows the world is not warming.
So Chris, I'm saying the data are mixed, which, by the way, look, the problem with this debate is you're demanding a religious
No, I'm not.
You are. Even the language of this debate, a climate denier. That's the language of theology. That's a heretic. You are a denier. You know, throughout science,
Why do you think you should test
the data.
So here's my second question. And I've spent a lot of time with climate scientists. So I would like a theory of why it is that 99% of climate scientists, these are people that are work in the bowels of different universities. They're people, I've met them. I've gone out to Nebraska. I've talked to them in Texas and in Austin. There's actually some great climate scientists. What is the theory for how they're all collectively getting it wrong?
And by the way, that stat, which the stat that gets recited almost like a mantra, it's not 99, it's 97%, is based on one ridiculous and bogus study. Look, you guys can laugh, where they emailed a bunch of people described, most of them didn't respond. They came out with that stat, and it gets responded as, don't discuss facts or evidence. But hold on, let me stop for a second.
Well, what's the theory here?
Let me stop for a second. The theory is we should respond to data and evidence and actual facts. But let's talk about the environment more broadly. I believe we have a responsibility to clean up the environment. I want clean air. I want clean water. My children breathe and drink water. I'd like my grandchildren to be able to breathe and drink clean water. I think we ought to talk about part of the zealotry of this issue is it shifts away. So just this past week, I'm on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We passed a bill of which I'm a co-sponsor called the Save Our Seas legislation. Mm-hmm. If you look at plastic waste in our seas, 90% of the waste, the plastic waste in our oceans, comes from 10 rivers, 8 of which are in Asia, 2 of which are in Africa. If you want to reduce plastics in our ocean that are killing turtles, that are killing fish, that's unambiguously good, reducing that pollution. Save Our Seas legislation that we just passed out of committee, I hope we get signed into law soon, has the United States leaning in, working with those governments to clean up that pollution to reduce it. Let me say something else. Economic prosperity. Mm-hmm. State of Texas, carbon monoxide in the state of Texas since 2000, carbon monoxide emissions have dropped 75% in the state of Texas.
That's great.
Texas has a tremendous record, and here's where I've got
a
problem.
Wait a second.
Go ahead.
I get all this, and that's great. I just want to just mark this because I think I thought I would come into this, and particularly because I saw Dan Crenshaw, and I've seen more conservatives saying this. Like, I thought what you were going to say is, yes, all of that's true, but modeling is incredibly unreliable. We don't know what the future holds. We should be extremely circumspect and prudential about actions we take that may affect the prosperity of our government, et cetera, right? But what I'm hearing from you, and I think, I guess I wonder how curious this whole is, like, you just aren't sold on the basic connection, the basic platform belief of the IPCC and basically every major Democratic Party in the entire OECD and scientific community. You are not sold on that basic story about what is happening between carbon warming and what we need to do.
Politically, a large percentage of the political leaders who are advocating this are also advocating massive government control of the economy and socialism. I think much of what's going on politically is that you have politicians who are socialists, whether they admit it or not, and climate is a good excuse to say, you've got to have socialism or else all of humanity is going to die. So it has a way to frame it as, I'm saving the world, and anyone who disagrees wants every person on earth to live. When you put it in those bold moral terms, by the way, we should always be a little scared of politicians who hold themselves out as the savior for the world. That has not worked out well historically.
But I think what you're saying there, which I think is actually a crucial insight here, because I do think that a lot of conservatives are kind of reasoning in that exactly that way, which is, I don't like socialism. I don't like state control. I don't like a large regulatory state. I don't want there to be crackdown on oil companies and bans on frackings and things like that. Ergo, in this sort of like retroactive reasoning way, they got to be wrong about what the thing they're saying is the problem. But like, we could just have like a carbon fee and dividend, or there's a bunch of things that like conservatives could say. And there are some conservatives who support. Once you say, look, the basic story here is just unavoidable.
So, Chris, let me ask you something. Do you know what person in modern times has had the single greatest impact reducing carbon emissions of any human being alive?
I don't.
There's a clear and objective answer to that. And the answer to that is a fellow named George Mitchell. George Mitchell was a Texas oil man.
I thought you were going to say Ronald Reagan.
No. Although that's always a good guess for me. Reagan is pretty much the answer to everything. So
As he walked across the water, he was taking the carbon out of the air.
I take that as a fair point.
I
have a giant bust of Reagan in my office. You look at George Mitchell. George Mitchell was the son of Greek goat herders. Mm-hmm. He came to Texas, came to Galveston, founded the Woodlands, and George Mitchell pioneered fracking. Now, fracking has become demonized, but fracking unlocked massive shale deposits of both natural gas and oils, totally transformed the geopolitical world, and in particular has resulted in an incredible shift from coal power production to natural gas power production. There is nothing, no socialist regulator, no Paris deal, nothing has had anywhere close to as a big an impact on carbon emissions as has a Texas oil man innovating fracking and moving away from coal to natural gas. I think that's how we should address the environment through innovation that also produces jobs.
So I will say the last point on this, and I think we can move to other stuff, is that I actually agree. So I actually think that
my job here is done.
Producing the framework for innovation that innovates us away from fossil fuel is absolutely the most vital thing we can do. There's already amazing explosion in wind and solar. There could be all kinds of things that we don't even realize at this point that are carbon-free, fossil-free forms of energy. And that it's extremely exciting to imagine a world in which we create the conditions for that innovation to happen, create lots of new jobs, boost the American economy, distribute power, which we don't have right now. We have an incredibly concentrated power system.
Okay, by the way, distributing power scares the hell out of me. To be honest, Mao and Stalin talked about distributing power. Distributing power is inevitably...
I mean the electrons.
No.
I just mean like...
I physically mean the actual power sources. Then we were talking about different things. That's thoroughly amusing.
So let me...
I thought you were saying power to the people, and I'm like...
Well, I believe in that too, but in this case, I just mean literally.
So I do too. I just don't want government to take the power and then claim it's going to give it back. I just want to leave it with the people. Let me just very briefly, before we leave this topic... On a little bit of substance and specifics, several weeks ago, as you know, CNN did, 700 hours of climate debate with all 400 Democratic candidates.
It was 9.
Okay. I only watched sort of snippets of it afterwards. I saw one snippet where Elizabeth Warren was asked, and she was asked about energy, and she was asked, look, nuclear power doesn't have carbon emissions. If you care about carbon emissions, shouldn't you be for nuclear power? And this is a good idea. And her answer, she said, I hear what you're saying, but no. If I'm elected president, there will be zero new nuclear plants. Okay. And I actually engaged in this a little bit because if you actually are trying to have a serious public policy position, her position, as I understand it, she said categorically no nukes. She also believes no coal. She also is...
She doesn't have to do anything. Thanks to George Mitchell, there's very little she has to do to kill off coal.
There's still substantial coal, though. It is challenged dramatically by natural gas. But she also has talked about banning fracking. Mm-hmm. So I guess electric is okay, although electricity comes principally from natural gas and coal. And if you have no fracking and no coal, I don't know where the electricity comes from. And so my question is, where do you... like? Planes run on jet fuel. If you have no gasoline and no jet fuel, I mean, you're literally, planes are flying on pixie dust, and we put windmills on our cars. That's not anything resembling a serious energy policy. And by the way, Texas leads the nation in wind production. I'm all for alternatives, right. But you can't run an airplane
right.
on wind. It doesn't work that way. You can get up on a glider and take a hot air balloon, but it'll take you a
while. I mean, you can't right now, but this is more computing power that fit an entire building 30 years ago. So, God bless American innovation. Amen. Let's hope we get to the point where planes don't need fossil fuel.
Good. Okay, so here's some common ground, and maybe we can end up with that. I absolutely believe there will come a time, and it may be relatively soon, where we move away from fossil fuel. I don't know if it's 10 years or 50 years or 100 years. I don't know. What I do know is that I don't think it's going to be Washington bureaucrats who figure it out. I think they're almost certain to get it wrong. And I think it will come from private sector innovation. Nobody saw fracking coming until George Mitchell just began experimenting. It was a technological marvel that transformed the energy picture. I'll make a prediction. When we move to whatever alternative energy source becomes the next one, and much of humanity's progress has been from one energy source to another, whether steam, whether burning wood, whether coal. I mean,
but we've been stuck on fossil fuels for about 180 years.
Well, although I will say, actually moving, so even moving to coal actually saved millions of lives and cleaned up the environment dramatically.
Totally, yes.
Because before that, people had wood stoves. Yep. And the pollution they were breathing in was much worse. So we have been steadily improving. Now moving from coal to natural gas is an improvement. Here's my prediction. Whatever the next energy source is that becomes the dominant one, I think it's actually going to be Texas entrepreneurs driving it. Because what I think Texas is good at is being energy entrepreneurs. And I want a business environment, an economic environment, where those small businesses are innovating and creating those new opportunities.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with that. And I think that the subsidies we give to oil companies are stand in the way of that. I think that And we give a lot.
So I'm curious. Look, I'm against subsidies, and I've advocated we should have no subsidies in energy across the board. We shouldn't pick winners and losers. I will say, though, it is a common talking point about all the subsidies we give oil and gas. Let me ask you, what
huge stuff on the tax depreciation and capital side that they take a special advantage of? Because it is capital intensive, but if you look at the analysis of where the breakdown of those cuts go, they go primarily and overwhelmingly to fossil fuel extractions.
So I will point out the rhetoric that goes into this, because I'm all for ending subsidies. But the rhetoric that goes behind this, the depletion allowance, is in any other business, if you invest in a factory, you're allowed to take depreciation on that factory. That's how business accounting works. And the rhetoric of this is they say, you know what, the same accounting every other business does, when an oil and gas operator does it, it's suddenly a subsidy for them. No, allowing them to take
totally
the same business deductions everyone takes, which is, in other words, measuring real profits, that's not a subsidy.
I disagree, because I think extraction is fundamentally different than what a factory does, but let's just leave that aside. Let me ask you.
But I will agree on ending subsidies. Now, would you end all energy subsidies?
No,
or just the energy?
No, I think the government should put the thumb on the scale, because
I'd end them all. But yeah. we're halfway there.
Well, I mean, partly because we don't agree on what the underlying problem is, right? I think that the science is extremely clear on climate, and I think that there's a prudential need to act very quickly, and I think the prudential need to act very quickly shows that there's a few things. One, government could do basic research. We've seen a decline in basic research year over year, right? It's not good. We can also do a lot of things to create the conditions to price externalities, like the price of carbon pollution. We can do things to promote the production of intellectual property in energy innovation, put people to work, export that to the rest of the world. Like, there's a lot of good stuff to do as we move from fossil fuel extraction to the next energy economy.
So let me ask a simple yes-no question. Do you think if a Democrat is elected in 2020 that he or she should implement policies to ban fracking in the United States?
I'm not sure they can, actually.
Assume they can. You're right.
I don't think they can.
So I don't either, but I also think the odds are high that a number of the Democrats running would try anyway,
I basically,
and then it'd be tied up in litigation. So for a second,
I mean, I'm not
hold
ready for
off
presence,
the question.
I don't have
of
a policy position
of it.
But I would say,
would you support the policy of banning fracking?
I think not immediate, but I think you would have to do some sort of sliding scale. I mean, you'd have to put it on some sort of road, 3 to 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, something like that.
So look, I have to say, I think, and I'm glad for that clarity. I hope all the 2020 Democratic candidates have that degree of clarity.
Warren says day one, and Sanders says he wouldn't do what day one.
And doing it day one, the projections are, would cost 14 million jobs nationally, and the state of Texas would cost 1.5 million jobs. I think it is hard to find something that would be more economically devastating than doing that. And I think that's an example of how, look, the Democratic side.
Wait a second. I have to just respond to this, and I don't want to keep going around in circles on this. But what that does is it's only looking at one part of the ledger. Because if you don't think there's any cost to the world warming at the rate it's warming, all you look at is you say, well, the 1 million jobs are gone. But if temperatures are going through the roof, if El Paso has more 100-degree days than it ever has in history, as it did this summer, if heat-borne illness starts creeping up north, if droughts and flooding and natural storms create billions of dollars of both human loss and economic loss, then you have to look at the totality of it. If you hand wave away one side of it and say, that isn't happening, it isn't getting warmer. All you farmers out there that are changing your crops, you're crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. The data is muddled. Then you have gotten rid of one side of the ledger when you evaluate the efficacy of whatever policy you're doing.
So, look, we got lots of people cheering here in Austin. But, you know, I'm reminded of actually something that, Reagan said in the 1980 campaign. And I did that on purpose. Which is, he said, recession is when your neighbor loses his job. Depression is when you lose yours.
Right.
That's very easy for you to say that. Are you willing to lose your job in 2021 as a result of it? Look, it's easy in Travis County for people who are wealthy and college educated and doing well.
I don't want anyone to lose their job.
Let's take away 1.5 million jobs in Texas. I encourage you, come down to South Texas and meet households, meet Hispanic men and single moms who are providing for their families, whose incomes are going... Sir, please don't just scream that. This is meant to be a discussion. I think it is foolish and wrong for Democratic presidential candidates to cavalierly be prepared to tell 14 million people who are predominantly middle income or low income, you guys are out of a job. I think that's wrong. I think we ought to be fighting for jobs.
Let me respond in two ways. One is, there's a bunch of miners down in Harlan County right now who haven't been paid. Their mine shut down. They've been standing athwart the railroad into that mine for several weeks. There's miners out in Wyoming who just lost their job. As far as I can tell, no one in government is doing anything for them. We did a story and we sent our reporter out to that mine in Wyoming. I want those people to be taken care of. I want them to have jobs. I want them to have health care. I want them to have pensions. And in fact, I think the Democratic candidates do. And I think we agree that people shouldn't just be tossed on the ash heap. I want to turn to the news of the week because we haven't talked about it. I understand a few things, I think, of the psychology of folks who are viewing what's happening this week. And I've heard you talk about it, which is the Democrats have wanted him gone from day one. Essentially, all of this is pretextual. They're roving around. They've come to the conclusion and they're looking for the facts to backfill. They are succumbing to pressure from their far left, etc. I get all that. But I just want to focus on the transcript and the call. I was going back and watching folks on the Democratic side react to Bill Clinton back in 98. And basically everyone was like, yeah, dude, that's not cool. Like, it's just not cool. Now, you can say it's not impeachable, but it's not okay. Like, you shouldn't have done that. Do you feel that way about the exchange with Zelensky? That it's not okay? Like, I'm not telling you, I'm not saying you support impeachment, he should be run out of office. I'm just saying, evaluate it on its terms. As the president of the United States, he brings up the military aid. He says, I want you to do me a favor, though, and he makes two asks. I think that's inappropriate. I think a lot of people think that's inappropriate. And it has been weird to me to not see more Republicans just say he shouldn't have done that.
So let's break it down. I've read the entire transcript.
Me too, yeah.
I've also read what's being referred to as the whistleblower complaint. And I've read them both cover to cover. As you noted, there are two asks in the transcript. I have to say, first of all, what was said about the transcript, when I picked it up to read it, I expected it to be much worse than it was, because for days, all of the discussion on TV had been that it was alleged to be an illegal quid pro quo. So when I picked up the transcript, look, I didn't know what I would see. As you noted, there were two asks. The first ask was the president ask Ukraine to assist in investigating interference into the 2016 presidential election. I think that ask is unequivocally proper, and it cannot be the case that it is inappropriate as a law enforcement matter for the federal government to investigate foreign interference in our elections, given that we've been doing
it
for
second.
Two and a half years.
Okay, let's stop right there. He says, CrowdStrike, the server, I think a rich Ukrainian has it. Can you look into that? Do you understand what he's saying there?
I have no idea.
And okay, wait, look, but I want to be clear about it because this is the President of the United States. CrowdStrike is the firm the DNC hired to do their forensics after the breach. There is a conspiracy theory that is completely, completely unsupported by the evidence that CrowdStrike colluded with Ukrainian interests and the DNC to frame Russia for the hack and that it wasn't Russia. When he says CrowdStrike, I think they have the server, a rich Ukrainian, what the President of the United States is saying, Russia didn't do the hack. Please look into the con job that was done by this firm to make it look like Russia did it.
Okay, now, of course, that's not what he said. You're doing a little bit like Adam Schiff and sort of putting
I'm saying
that he didn't actually say.
No, he said CrowdStrike.
Look, here's
CrowdStrike and a rich Ukrainian has
a server. I don't know what happened or not. My point is that asking for an investigation into foreign interference into our elections is a perfectly appropriate law enforcement function. And you believe that because for 2 years on MSNBC, the only topic of discussion has been Russia interfering in our elections.
Wait a second.
It's perfectly appropriate if there was other interference to say investigate to it. That's not an illegitimate purpose.
Totally true, but there has to be a predicate for investigations, as you would agree. You're a lawyer. We don't just do investigations based on nothing. I won't say, I'm investigating Ted Cruz today, or I'm investigating Rand Paul, or I'm investigating Adam Schiff. There's a factual predicate. In the case of Russia, the factual predicate was, and I think you agree with this, Russia hacked into the DNC servers, and they hacked Podesta's emails.
And Russia attempted to interfere in our election.
You agree with
wrong.
That?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Look, I am no fan of Vladimir Putin.
No, I just want to make sure that we're in agreement on that. In that case, the factual predicate is that Russia did it. Like, we saw the email. Someone hacked the DNC.
Okay, but
in this case, there's no factual predicate for an investigation.
The fact that Russia did it doesn't mean nobody else was attempting to interfere in our election. And in fact, we have had a long history of other countries
totally agree. Trying to interfere in our election. Totally agree. I'm just saying investigations have to be based on factual predicates. In the case of Russia, the factual predicate is that Russia hacked the servers. In the case of this CrowdStrike Ukraine stuff, there's no factual credit because it's a crazy theory.
Look, I don't know what the factual predicate is or not. I don't think it. I think it is a legitimate law enforcement purpose to investigate whether there was foreign interference. Now, the second part is the Biden part, and I will readily acknowledge the Biden part is more troubling. It is not, on the face of the transcript, a quid pro quo, and it's certainly not an illegal quid pro quo. But look, in the legal world, there are principles of conflict of interest, and there's also a question of an appearance of impropriety. I would have wished the president had not gone down that road because at the very minimum, there's an appearance that I would rather he not have opened the door to. I got to tell you, Donald Trump says things frequently that I wish he wouldn't say. And I don't have control over that. The fact that he shouldn't have gone down that road is a long way from saying, therefore, he should be impeached and forcibly removed from office after the American people have voted in a presidential election. That is a big threshold.
Sure.
And there are a lot of Democrats who I think, and this is where you started, they're not focused on the facts. They want him impeached, and whatever the facts are fine.
Whether that's the case or not, and I think that might be true in some cases. In some cases, there are folks like Al Green who would readily agree because he's been calling for impeachment from the first week, right?
Sure.
So that's like a matter of fact,
yeah.
Right? Maxine Waters as well. But just to zoom in here, right? Like, it's not when you say the president says a lot of things I don't like. This is a little different than like a tweet or say it's a head of state. He represents the American people in that phone call. All of us. It's a public trust. He's talking to a head of state. He's not tweeting. He's not saying little Adam Schiff or whatever dumb thing he tweets. He's making an ask as the head of state. And it's an ask. He says, you should do this thing. That is an official act. I just want to be clear. That's not him saying a thing. He is acting when he gets on a call with a head of state in the same way that if Barack Obama got on the call with Rouhani and said, I'd like you to do us this favor, you would recognize immediately that that's an act.
So look, government leaders have conversations with other government leaders and they say all sorts of things. I will say I'm very glad that the president and the administration released the transcript. I think it was the right thing to do. Now, I think it's a dangerous precedent when you have heads of state speaking to each other, if they fear that it'll be released publicly, you do want them to be able to speak with a degree of candor. But I think it's good that the transcript was released because the sort of fevered conspiracy theories about what he in fact said, we now have the actual transcript of what he said. But I'll point out also, look, part of the allegations concerned Vice President Biden, look, I think it would also make sense for the administration to release transcripts of any conversations Biden had with Ukraine. Do the same standard, release Biden's transcripts and Trump's transcript, and we can see if there was anything illegitimate or not. We can see those conversations as well.
So two things about that. One is, on the Trump part of this, because he's the president right now, don't you think, I've seen a lot of people say this is hearsay, the whistleblower complaint. In the same light of the transparency, the whistleblower complaint, and don't you think we should just hear from the principals, the people directly, Kurt Volker, Masha Ivanovich, who was the ambassador recalled from Ukraine, about what they know? Like, we should just hear from them and do fact-finding to figure out what exactly happened here.
Look, I think there should be an investigation. And this week, I voted, and every member of the Senate voted unanimously to refer this matter to the Senate Intelligence Committee to investigate. Senate Intelligence Committee is Republican and Democrat, yep, both sides, and they'll investigate. And I assume
they'll talk to those people.
They will talk to the relevant people. Yes, I agree it should be investigated. But I'll point out there are a lot of Democrats who are saying impeach him now. Before anything's investigated, before they know any facts, their starting point is impeach him. Well, so I can promise you once an investigation happens, their end point is still going to be impeach him. They've made up their mind. And they're telling us.
By the way, you're right about that. They are doing fact finding, but let me just, we'll end here because we're sort of running up against time. But I'm just going to tell you what their thinking is about the facts as we know them. And then you could respond. So we know it's not disputed. The president personally ordered $400 million in military aid to Ukraine to be paused or stopped. In fact, this was troubling to you and your colleagues, including Lindsey Graham, who at one point threatened to join Dick Durbin in withholding $5 billion in Pentagon aid unless the money was released. Mitch McConnell asked questions about where it had gone because you guys in both houses wanted them to have this aid because Russia's occupying their country. So we know the president ordered the aid stopped 1 week before he made the phone call. Established. We know that he got on the phone with Zelensky and he said, I'd like you to do me a favor. And he made those two asks, as you said. One of them is investigate my rival and his son. We know that he told him to work with his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and the Department of Justice Attorney General, the chief law enforcement of the country, on that investigation. We know that the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, has both publicly and privately said he wants to, and I'm quoting him here, meddle in the investigation in Ukraine, and has met with up to five prosecutors, sometimes coordinated through the State Department, with the express intent, as he says all the time, all day on Fox News, with getting them to reopen investigation into Vice President Biden and his son. There are people that think that is itself an impeachable abuse of power. And I have not mentioned anything that is factually disputed.
Well, let's go through that a little bit because that there are several pieces of it. First of all, in terms of delaying or withholding Ukrainian aid, listen, the president has been skeptical of all sorts of foreign aid. So he's been holding back foreign aid from a lot of countries. He's much more skeptical than Congress. And when it comes to Ukraine aid, by the way, I was vigorously skeptical of President Obama, who was unwilling to provide lethal offensive weapons for Ukraine to defend itself against Russia. And I advocated for Obama to do it. I advocated for Trump to do it. And in fact, again, going on substance to Ukraine and Russia, just a few weeks ago, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee passed my legislation to sanction the companies building Nord Stream 2, the pipeline from Russia to Germany, natural gas pipeline that skips Ukraine. That bill that I introduced passed the Foreign Relations Committee by a vote of 20-2, an overwhelming bipartisan legislation that will hurt Russia and help Europe. On the rest of it, listen, Rudy.
Wait, just stop there. You believe that your interpretation of his sudden halt on this money, which everyone agreed on, this was not a controversial thing, was because of a skepticism about all foreign aid or Ukraine?
So here's where you said it's an established fact that it's established fact that precisely 1 week before he personally ordered it. I don't know that that's established. Look, all sorts of things. That's actually what an investigation would figure out.
To the extent that it's not established, we should establish it.
It's I have heard that alleged on Twitter. That's different from being an established fact. Rudy Giuliani, with regards to what Rudy said to anyone, I have no idea. And you're going to have to ask Rudy that.
That's a safe position to take respect to Rudy Giuliani.
I'm just saying that one you're going to have to.
But he is acting on the president's behalf, and it is a little weird and not great to have him running around doing that.
And listen, Rudy says he was coordinating with the State Department. I don't know what the facts are. I think that's perfectly legitimate to investigate, figure out what the facts are. In terms of the Department of Justice. So you said he asked to talk to the Department of Justice on all of this. I don't think it's clear from the transcript it is on all of this. And I will say...
No, he says Barr, though. He says talk to Barr.
He says talk to Barr. So I will say, having been in many conversations with Donald Trump, you'll be sitting there and the topics can vary very quickly. And you'll be sitting there and he'll say, hey, talk to so-and-so on this. And it's not like he's got a list of here are the four people that are executing. As he thinks of something, he'll say, oh, talk to so-and-so.
Yes.
And so I know the Department of Justice has put out a statement that Barr said he's never had a conversation with Trump about Ukraine. He's never had any conversation with Ukraine. And so they've been unequivocal.
They deny,
insofar as Ukraine, they were not involved.
Right.
I find that entirely plausible that having been in enough conversations with the president, he'll mention, particularly he's talking about election interference. He knows the Department of Justice has an investigation into that. I think it's a fairly natural thing to say, talk to Barr because DOJ is leading that investigation. You can build up all sorts of inferences, and I think we should look and see what the facts are. But I also think what's driving the fury in the House is not the specific facts of this allegation. It was something else a month ago. It'll be something different in another month. And it is that they cannot stand Donald Trump, and they want him removed. And I get... They don't
like. Are those people applauding that sentiment or the description?
But look, elections. I believe in the democratic process, and I do not think we should be subverting the result of a democratic election. If you don't like Donald Trump, go out and campaign to win in 2020.
I mean, the thing I would say about that is the House couldn't impeach Donald Trump if they didn't win the 2018 election.
Sure, no. They have the power to.
In fact, when you came in 2013, right? I mean. The big shutdown that happened, right, when you first came in was the combination of the House having the power it had because elections don't stop after 2008. There was a Republican House in 2008.
So I was elected in 2013. I served 4 years when Barack Obama, I was elected in 2012, came in 2013. I served 4 years with Barack Obama as president. I disagreed with President Obama on a lot of issues. I didn't call for his impeachment. I didn't think he should be impeached just because I disagreed with him.
I agree.
The remedy, someone is implementing bad policies, and I think the policies under Obama did enormous harm, the remedy is to go and win an election, which in 2016, the Republicans didn't win an election. That's how our democratic process works.
I will say, yeah.
And let me just make a final point, just not to lose sight of, because I know we're running out of time. Yeah. If you set aside all of the crazy circus, because I'll say there's a disconnect in Washington, every question this week is Ukraine.
And we did 10 minutes on it.
I congratulate you for not starting there. I'm glad we talked substance. I can tell you outside of Washington, what I hear from people in Texas they care about is they care about jobs. They care about their family. They care about their kids.
Healthcare.
They care about healthcare. Absolutely. Healthcare premiums under Obamacare have skyrocketed, and people can't afford health insurance under Obamacare. By the way, hissing doesn't solve the fact that the average family's premiums have risen over $5,000 a year. But here are some facts. We have today the lowest unemployment in 50 years. We've got the lowest African-American unemployment that has ever been recorded in the history of our country. We have the lowest Hispanic unemployment that has ever been recorded. We have 6 million people who've come off of food stamps. We have the lowest African-American poverty ever recorded in the history of the country. We have the lowest Hispanic poverty ever recorded in the history of the country. And so at least some of the discussion... Even if politically you're angry and worked up, I think some of the discussion ought to be, look, people's lives are being benefited by having good jobs. By the way, incomes are rising in the number one state in the country for income increases in the state of Texas. People's lives are being made better by economic prosperity, and that is my number one priority.
And let me say this. Economic growth is great. We've started to see a little bit of movement on the wages, although there's still that's still been a lagging indicator, I think, because of the structural power that labor has. But I don't disagree that I think tight labor markets and economic growth are great. I think they do great things. They bring people off the sidelines. I would like to see that continue. I happen to think that if you look at the trend line from Barack Obama in terms of job growth, it goes straight. There were more jobs created under Barack Obama's first 3 years than there have been in the same amount of time. That's just facts. But that said, I would like to see the economy go along at this pace for as long as possible. I hope we don't have a recession. I hope the Fed is accommodating in policy, which is something that Donald Trump and I agree about. And it was great to talk to you, Senator Ted Cruz. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. I enjoyed this.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks to Senator Ted Cruz and his staff for agreeing to do this conversation. Credit to them for agreeing to do it. And, you know, it was an hour with just me on stage. There's nothing out of bounds. A real conversation. Not all politicians are willing to do that. In fact, it's a great frustration of mine that more aren't. So thank you to the senator and to his staff for facilitating that. Like I said, this was live with pod number one of this fall. The next one's going to be coming up October 21st in Los Angeles. You can still get tickets, but Tiffany and I were checking today, and the best available seats keep marching back in the auditorium, which suggests that they're going quickly, and pretty soon you won't be able to get tickets. And I would love for the people to be there to be people that are WithPod listeners and fans. We love hearing from you guys when you email us at withpod@gmail.com or tweet us with the hashtag WithPod. We love the kind of conversation that we've established with you guys. I'd love to kind of meet some of you at this event. So I hope that we can come out in Los Angeles and we can all be a part of this together. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to NBCNews.com/Why Is This Happening.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.